British Antarctic Survey Archives, Oral History Recording Number 4, Dr. E. H. Back. A recording of Dr. Back, Medical Officer with Operation Tabarin between 1943 and 1946, in conversation with Miss Joanna Ray, Assistant Archivist of the British Antarctic Survey. Date, the 8th of October 1986. Location, British Antarctic Survey Headquarters, Cambridge.
Could you give me an outline of your career before joining Operation Tabarin?
I went to school at Marlborough and came up to Cambridge in 1938 at the major scholarship, the Clare College, Cambridge. I read medicine and qualified in 1943. After 6 months working in a hospital, I joined the RNVR in September of 1943. I had undertaken the normal introductory courses on four newly joined medical officers, and then I heard about Operation Tabarin.
How did you come to hear about it?
It happened indirectly, because in August of 1943 I was best man at a wedding in Birmingham, at which Dr. Marr was present. Dr. Marr was James Marr's brother, and he was indirectly responsible for my being asked to join the expedition. I was asked by the Navy to meet Lieutenant Marr at the Colonial Office, and he outlined the expedition, and it was arranged with the Admiralty that I should join.
What was your immediate reaction when he suggested it?
Well, it was every schoolboy's dream to have gone to the Antarctic. I'd read all the Antarctic books in the library at school, mm-hmm. and I was always keen, though I never thought I'd have the chance of going.
Mm-hmm. Were you told anything of the purpose of the expedition?
No, that in wartime you didn't ask purposes of military exercise. As far as I was concerned, this was a job that they wanted an able doctor to do, and it sounded the sort of job that I would like to do. Mm. So possibly neglecting the standard service routine of never volunteering for anything, I volunteered.
Did you see it primarily, in your own view, as a military or scientific exercise?
Well, basically, that in 1943, that everything was of military importance, and that one could see that with the Mediterranean at that time, it had only just been opened, there was a lot of traffic going round the Horn and going round the Cape, and that to have a base south of the Antarctic, of the main fronts and the depressions, would obviously be of use. That I had a certain amount of meteorological experience before, that when I was at school, that I ran the meteorological station, which has been at Marlborough College since the 1860s. If you look at the recent annual report of the monthly weather report issued just the other day, you will notice that Marlborough is one of those stations that has been recording ever since the monthly weather report was first started in 1884. My grandfather was a naval doctor who went to sea in sail. He kept regular meteorological observations during his time, and that I inherited from him a thermometer, which I still have, and that I have kept records of the weather since I was nine. Mm-hmm.
So when you went south, was it on the understanding that you would be doing meteorological work as well?
Yes, I don't think it was a entire surprise to the members organising the expedition. I knew anything about Met at all. That the Met officer was Gordon Hawkins, who'd previously been in Falklands, and that he provided me with some books, and he provided some equipment, and so off we went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Time must have been very short in organising everything before the expedition sailed. Could you tell me about your involvement in the preparations?
Yes, and the Met apparatus, that was all organised by the Admiralty. As far as medical stores were concerned, that I was told you can order anything you like, but you aren't allowed to talk to anybody about it. I had a very brief visit with Surgeon Commander Bingham, that who said, gave me two bits of advice. One was true and one was not. He said deception is just like England, which is not true, and that Resinal is excellent treatment for phosphate, which it is. But otherwise, I was left entirely on my own, that I ordered far too much equipment, and quite likely some of it is still being used by the Argentines in Hope Bay.
Had you had any experience on particular polio problems at all, of medical nature?
No, that one had no knowledge that one had read, and I've read the all the classical Antarctic books on, I've read Scott and Shackleton, and that the medical aspects were not they aren't very detailed. The one thing that I did know about was scurvy, and so that we took our 50 milligrams of ascorbic acid every day, and otherwise it was very much a question of thinking what you wanted. We were, of course, before penicillin hadn't been invented, we had sulfonamide, and the ship, there is a standard ship's equipment, a very good library provided by the Navy for junior medical officers, and so I ordered that, but somebody left on the jetty in Montevideo, so the whole time I was down south, the only medical book I had was AIDS Tropical Diseases. I don't think my colleagues actually knew those, and they all thought I was quite a good doctor.
The ship that you were originally intending to sail in was the HMS Bransfield. Could you tell me a little bit about the ship and its problems?
Yes, the Bransfield, Mar found this up in Iceland. She was a sealer. And that she'd been tootling around in the Arctic for many years. Well, she was a wooden ship, and that she was brought down and commissioned. But I think I should say the tremendous amount of hard work that Mar did to get this expedition going, that he got the whole thing organised in the matter of 3 months from start to finish, that and he got a rather motley collection, probably under modern standards, of the of crew. But when we see the advertisements of how people are now chosen to go to the Antarctic, I don't think any of us would have qualified at all. But he got all this organised, and he got over a tremendous lot of difficulties, and he got us the Operation Tabran landed in the Antarctic when he was supposed to, and that the I don't think any credit could be too high for his organising ability to get this out. That he was not helped, I don't think, very much by various civil servants in the colonial
office.
Was
there any one detail to assist him from the colonial office or something?
Oh yes, there was that he was immortalised actually in one in the ABC in the Hope Bay Harbour. That A is for Ashton, who built a fine house, and also for someone with the brains of a louse. That we will say no more about this gentleman. I believe he got an OBE for our troubles.
So you, when did you meet the rest of the expedition? Was it when
we met various of them that appeared at the. By the time the Navy had sorted me out from doing. Gas training and other forms of training. It was the 25th of October when I joined in 2 Park Street Mayfair, which is just behind the R&VR Club. And the ship actually sailed on the 9th of November, so that they really did get a tremendous move on. I stayed with some friends in North London, and I used to trundle down to the Bransfield on the old steam railway, and that somehow or other all the stores got ordered and all got on board. But exactly who one met when, I can't very much remember, but we met up 101, and eventually we were all piled into the ship in London docks, and off we went in the November fog.
When I spoke to Mr. Davis, he said there was a send-off party.
Oh yes, the send-off party was held at the Goring Hotel, and that we were being sent off. We were not allowed to invite sweethearts, wives, mothers, because it was all too secret for that. But we were sent off by the Colonial Office and the various people there, and as we walked out, we were asked to cough up £3 for the privilege, which did not seem to be very... I might say we eventually got that back again.
Oh, that's...
Did David say that one?
No, he didn't.
He didn't?
Oh,
so that...
got the money back.
Oh, did he? Perhaps he didn't. But it was a whole... During the time this was going on, because of the wartime secrecy, I think people don't realise that in wartime, you didn't ask any questions about anything. And so that no one knew you were going to the Antarctic, and if you were issued with warm clothing, you probably meant you were going to the tropics.
So you boarded the Bransfield.
We boarded the Bransfield, the first day we chugged down and got as far as Tilbury, and then we all went ashore, and because Tom Berry lived in Gravesend, and then the next day we got down to Southend, and a convoy was duly assembled, and I think Marchese, being a sort of senior officer, was thought to be, he'd be in charge of the escort, but he didn't realise quite how slow it was. So eventually we trundled off, and we went through the Straits of Dover in the middle of the night, underneath the German guns in Cape Greenay. And when morning broke, there was no sign of any convoy, because the Bransfield couldn't go that fast, and the ship wouldn't go very fast. Everybody seemed to say it was leaking. I didn't know if it was leaking then. Generally, the engines weren't working very well, so we went into Portsmouth. And so within about 4 days of having said goodbye to our loved ones for the next 2 years, there we were back home again.
And so from there you went on...
The next time we started on another convoy after about 4 days, and we got as far... The next day we went from Portsmouth as far as Portland, and by this time it was a Thanksgiving day, and so that I spent a very happy evening in the Gloucester Hotel with various Americans, enjoying Thanksgiving. After that we made Dartmouth, and then we went from Dartmouth to Falmouth, which was supposed to be our last port of call before we went to Freetown. Going down channel, we ran into a Force 9 gale, and the ship started to leak, and the engineer told the captain that the pumps wouldn't work. We had to stop the ship so that the pumps could pump, and it all looked rather unhappy on the whole, and nobody quite knew where we were, and that... There was a short clearance in the weather, and there was a lump of Cornwall visible, and I said, right, that is the Doddon, because I'd been down there on my father's ship, HMS Westcott, some 10 years previously.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we got into Falmouth, sailing straight across the minefield, to cries of what ship, and because nobody ever heard of HMS Bransfield, presumably because we were wooden, we didn't set the minefield off.
Mm-hmm.
And by this, going down channel, Ma still thought we were going to get to... Falklands in the Bransfield, anybody else did. He dove out all the polar clothing in the channel.
Mm.
But by the time we got to Falmouth, it's quite obvious that we weren't going to get much further, and so we sort of sat there while further contemplation was made, how are we going to get any further?
Mm. Was that Mars' responsibility to try and find an alternative?
Yes, I suppose he was. With remarkable swiftness, they discovered that there was the Highland Monarch, which is a new South American fruit ship, for meat ship, that she was about to sail to the Falklands with a relief garrison. And on the way, she was calling at Gibraltar with large numbers of Gibraltarian exiles who were taken out from Gibraltar in 1940 when it was thought that there was going to be a siege, and they were now the men returning home. That on the subject of the Falklands, it's interesting, at the time when the Falkland War was on and afterwards, they were taught, and there's now been a garrison at the Falklands, that from 1940 until 1944, there was a garrison of 2,000 men in the Falklands, and they were being taken out by the Highland Monarch, and in the Highland Monarch was taking out 200 troops were going, it's a small, much smaller garrison under the command of Colonel Mombert, to relieve the Falkland garrison.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And I heard in various accounts that you spent 24 hours on the train.
There was a special train was organised to transport us with all our stores. There were 13 trucks and one passenger coach that was to take us from Falmouth to Bristol Avonmouth, where the Highland Monarch was about to sail. And that we started off early in the morning, and they said, we'll send you through just ahead of the Cornish Riviera. But they, that we didn't get very far before the railway seemed to have forgotten about that, so we pushed into sidings. We trundled slowly across the countryside of the West Country. We stopped at one occasion at Newton Abbot, and we all charged out at the signal box and proceeded to make some cup of tea. And we got to Bristol about 2 o'clock in the morning, whereupon somebody appeared and says, "Tickets, please." So this time, again, we discovered the ship wasn't going to sail for 2 days, and so we all beetled off home again, which surprised quite a lot of people, because nobody's supposed to leave ships when they're about to sail. So we came back 2 days later, and this time we actually did get off.
And so you eventually got down to the Antarctic. Could you tell me what your duties were then, at Base A to start with?
Well, at Base A, I was a doctor and the meteorologist, and the first thing that we stepped to do was to get the Met Station going. That was my particular job, and we did in fact get the Met observations started on the 1st of March, which is not bad, as we landed in February. Mm. That, of course, when we were the first thing to get ashore, was everybody was second-class wood butchers working under the command of Ashton, who was a master craftsman, and got this motley crew of people armed with hammers and nails to put the house together. We were quite well off to start with, because we went down the Antarctic, not only in the William Scoresby, which is built for ice and had been a whale catcher before, but there was the Fitzroy, which was a sort of passenger cargo ship which trundled along between Falklands, Montevideo, Punta Arenas, and South Georgia, so that she was not built for ice, but she was certainly built for bad weather. And so we lived in great comfort until the Fitzroy left at 3 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't even have the floor laid in the hut at that time, so that we had to turn to and lay the floor before we had anywhere to sleep on. The weather was about freezing, not very pleasant, but not all that cold. And the chief job for the first month or so was in getting ourselves established and fit to live.
Mm-hmm. Could you actually sleep in the hut by the time?
We slept in the hut the first night, but no, that's mm-hmm. We didn't have any tents. We're only on a very small island mm-hmm. in Port La Croix, and that in the summertime that was cut off by from the mainland. It was, you could walk across in the winter, you could walk across on the ice,
mm-hmm.
but in summer it was. We were cut off, and we had to work very a vast amount of hard labour in humping all the stores, getting things going, and the stoves and things all had to be unpacked, and everybody sort of mucked in doing all the jobs.
Mm. And did Ashton work to a plan? Was it a sort of prefabricated?
Yes, it was prefabricated. It came from Bolton Paul in Norwich. Only that part of the it was very carefully prefabricated with mortise and tenon joints, but the plan wasn't all that. I think the exact plan was suitable for putting it up on English summer, but not in Antarctic blizzards. So it, in fact, that although they were all marked, the Ashton mainly worked he put them all in the right place, but he did them all with nails, 6-inch nails, and the hut actually was extreme. It was a very nice hut.
Mm.
And in addition, that we got a certain amount of timber from Deception, which was used to build an extension on the hut.
Mm.
The Port Lockroy hut was an extremely nice one.
Mm.
Very comfortable.
Mm.
It took about 2 months to get it that stage.
Can you tell me, were there any problems with the meteorological equipment?
No, the only problem was that the clocks would permanently stop, that they were not, I don't think anybody had told them that they were supposed to be under polar conditions, so that we had a lot of trouble getting the clocks to go, and eventually we took them all to bits and treated them with graphite, and we got them going quite reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
But the instruments were very, very good. And we had an anemometer, and Mr. Ashton made a mast. He bought a pole from Deception 30 feet high, and he rigged this up behind the hut at Port Lockroy, and it worked very well for all the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
We got the observations. As soon as we were up, the observations were being sent off to Stanley, so that we got our numbers on the international register, and they were being sent out to the world from about a month after starting.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good record.
Mm.
And you were making regular readings?
Yes, I used to take 8 o'clock, 8, 11, 8, 11, 2, 4, 7, 10. That was my 6 observations a day, but I did nearly all of them myself. But in fact, in Port Lockroy, I did them all, and in Hope Bay, that one David James used to do them sometimes. But one of the advantages of doing the Met was that we were exempted from the job of doing bogeyman, as you had to get up early every day to read the weather.
Mm.
You did not have to light the stove as well. All the other people had to do that in turn.
But you didn't often have a lay-in?
No.
No. Did you mind that?
No, it was. One got used to it. Doing the Met, you've got a certain number of the more objectionable chores.
Mm. So it had its advantages.
And that, for example, if there was a smoko, because the snow had gone on top of the roof, when the stove was lit, all the smoke came out. It was somebody else always had to go out and clear the top.
Could you tell me something about living conditions in the hut?
Once we got established in Lockroy, that we were really extremely comfortable. We had two berth cabins with beds we found from Deception, so we had bunk beds one on top of the other, and that each pair had arranged various little bits and wardrobes and such like, which we made out of bits of packing case. And the Lockroy house was nice and was warm and comfortable. We had an Essie stove, which burnt continually. And for relaxation, that we had books sent up from the medical libraries, and all sorts of things came out. And somebody with a stroke of genius sent out a complete collection of all the William books. And when these first arrived, who they think we are sending all this sort of rubbish out, kids' rubbish out. And that was that. And then you would find, on a quiet evening, in a corner, you'd suddenly heard, and one after another, somebody was reading a William book. And every single William book was read by everybody with much enjoyment. Who thought of sending rough sailors William books? I don't know, but they were great.
And you had magazines as well?
Well, you had magazines a year old, and I had all my medical magazines, and I had a fair number before I went south, and Christmas 44, when the mail came out, there was a year's supply, and so I carefully annotated each one with the date, and opened one a week, so that I kept myself up to date to some extent with what was going on at home. But we had a gramophone, and said in the second year that David James had a very nice selection of records that he brought out.
Mm-hmm. It was up to you as individuals to bring that kind of thing, was it?
Yes, that, well, that again, there was a selection of records were provided by the Naval Company. So very good, actually. Mm-hmm.
What did you do about keeping the place clean and things like that? Because there weren't hoovers, obviously, in those days.
No, but again, there was the each day there was the bogeyman, and the bogeyman, he was responsible for keeping the stoves going and sort of for general tidying up. We did in fact have a handyman each year, who was expected to help the cook and just generally tidy things up.
Mm-hmm.
But and we did have a system whereby we definitely had a cook who did the cooking. Because Tom Berry, who was our cook both years, he'd been a purser in the Discovery, and he was trained in the merchant service. He was a master baker. That I mean, Hope Bay, within 48 hours of our first setting foot on Hope Bay, he had bread baked ashore. That and we
it
had.
It's been remarkable.
Yes.
Because you were only in it. It was a tin galley.
In the tin galley, there's a marvellous picture of him sitting on a saw. Looking at the tin galley, the stove, where we are all eating our first bread that he baked. We had very good food, a bit monotonous, and the tin milk all froze and went. It was pretty disgusting, but on the whole, the food was excellent. And we had a certain amount of fresh food came down from Port Stanley. We went down with 40 sheep and 8 oxen in the rigging, but unfortunately the temperature in La Croix was such that most of that had gone off within about a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, could you tell me some of the food you had, some of the meals, if you can remember?
Well, we had bully beef and stew and tinned vegetables of various sorts, lots of tinned fruit. More or less, vast amounts of chocolate. That was very nice. It was interesting that when we were working hard at Hope Bay, when Hope Bay is a lot colder than Lockroy, and that we were working against the winter to get the house finished, and that we were eating regularly, each man was eating half a pint of chocolate a day. And I worked out we were having our dietary was about 5,000 to 6,000 calories, which is quite fantastic. So one eats a tremendous lot.
Mm.
The food was very much as provided for HM ships, and very little fresh food, except when you've got penguin eggs in season, when a ship came down, there was some fresh vegetables came down from Stanley, which was very much appreciated, and otherwise out of the tin.
Mm-hmm. And did you eat seal meat?
Yes, we had seal meat. Seal meat, it's said to be an acquired taste. It entirely depends how hungry you are. If you are really hungry, like people like sledging are, that seal meat tastes nice. But seal liver is quite reasonable. Seal steak, I never did really thoroughly appreciate, but it was a change from bully beef. And Tom Berry could, in fact, produce, as it was on our midwinter meal, fried fillets of seal rossini that I didn't know if they'd gone down at the Ritz, but they weren't bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never frightfully enthusiastic about seal, and I've all had bully beef.
Now, what were the sledging rations like?
Sledging rations were, I didn't go on I only went on one short sledge trip from Hope Bay in the January 1946, so I'm not. They were adequate nutritionally, and people seemed to survive on them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were nothing like as good as it was either. It was very similar to the sort of stuff that Scott took with pemmican and that sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Very little, a bit of extra vitamins which they all took. But I haven't got I drew up a sledging ration. I've got it actually, but I haven't put it in today.
Yes, I think I've got a copy.
Yes, I've got a copy of it.
If we move on to the next question. Well, could we talk a little bit about Hope Bay, setting up the base?
Well, Hope Bay, that whereas Locroy was very much made up at the spur of the moment, because we started off with a rush when Ma first started to be assigned to do the job, and we were still living from hand to mouth when we got there, that Hope Bay was planned, and that the planning of Hope Bay, the setting up of Hope Bay, was started work during the winter of 1944, but Ma went up to Stanley in December 44 to meet the ship coming out from England and the new members, so that things were put into the ship at the right, so the things were supposed to come out first but went in last. And we did a lot of planning in Locroy about the loading of the stores and how we were going to do things. And the result of that we got off to a very good start in Hope Bay, that all the stores, it was decided in advance what stores were going to go into about five different piles, and these were all marked and everything as it landed. Each equipment, bit of scow road that arrived ashore, was put on the appropriate pile. That the first job that we did was to put up this Uncle Tom's cabin. It's a prefabricated shack made out of corrugated iron bits of deception timber, which had been more or less put together at Locroy, was put straight ashore from the Eagle, and in 48 hours that Tom Berry had bread baked inside it. And that this had a roof on it, and various people who liked the open their life, like Taft Davis, fairly soon moved out and camped in it. At the time when the Eagle finally left us, we spent a few days in this tin shack until the house was fit to go into. But the planning, it worked very well. Mm-hmm. The other thing, that a top priority was made, that the Norden Scales hut should be thoroughly investigated before anybody had been sort of charging around and making messes. So that this was properly surveyed, mostly by Taylor, before anybody got near it.
Mm. It must have been very interesting to find that as a relic.
Oh, this was fascinating to think that these men had survived the winter there 40 years previously. But I don't think that well appreciated that these three men, when they sat down for the winter at Hope Bay, that nobody on earth knew where they were. And because their ship that was going to pick them up had not come back, so obviously it sunk somewhere, that there were Norden Scales' party was at Snow Hill Island, which is a couple of hundred miles away, and they couldn't get there because they were cut off by water when they were trying to walk. And nobody knew they were at Hope Bay, because the people who landed them there, presumably, who were lost.
Mm.
And that the courage which they set to and killed off the penguins to eat during the winter, and kept their sledging rations so that they could walk next in the spring to get down to Snow Hill.
Mm.
Very, very fine piece of work.
Yes, you wonder how people can endure such conditions during the whole winter. Mm. So, the Eagle had a little bit of trouble before, forced her to leave early, in fact.
Yes, there were various things that went. The Eagle had one or two narrow squeaks. There was one occasion in which a large berg broke off the Hope Bay glass in the middle of a gale and came bearing down upon the Eagle and missed it literally by a whisker.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't sink it. There was another occasion when there was a loud bang and some gunpowder was lying around and gone off. And then finally she came back in March with some further load of equipment, a whole lot of stores which he hadn't managed to land before, and that there was a very severe storm 10 gale with a rapid drop of temperature, and she dragged her anchor, went out to sea, hit two icebergs, stove a bow in, and at one stage thought she was going to have to be beached, which would have certainly been the loss of the ship and probably most of the men.
Mm-hmm.
But by a superb act of seamanship that the captainship had got her back to Port Stanley, but it did mean that a lot of the equipment we ought to have had ashore, we actually didn't have in Hope Bay. So we were never as comfortable in Hope Bay as we had been in La Croix. We didn't. There was no. We were not short of anything. I think there was plenty of food, but it was much more monotonous than we had before.
Yeah, so you were sort of having to make do.
Yes.
Mm. Yes. I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the more humorous aspects of life down south, and particularly the base magazines.
Yes, well, the base magazines that there was a thought that we all, that everybody knows about Scott's South Polar Times, and that we felt that we ought to try and do something, and that in the first year we had the Port Lockroy Prattler, which was never, it was never got properly going, because we didn't have anybody who had any journalistic art at all, and but the second year that we had that David James was the leading light of inspiring the Hope Bay Harbour, that Lamb was a masterly artist who drew the back plates, which are a very good example of Antarctic life, and that various people were conscripted into writing articles for it. Mm-hmm. And that some of the advertisements are really quite amusing. That this was a house advertising deception with all mod con only 8,000 miles from London. And we had a lot of fun out of this. David James started off in fine style, and the first edition came out for Midwinter's Day in June 45. I'm not quite sure what happened after that, but I was then volunteered to be editor thereafter, and I couldn't type, so I was taught to type, and we used to produce these. We produced from June till December 45, and we had articles from our people in Deception, the people in La Croix, and there are a number of our items how I came to the Antarctic, and that I think you've got copies of them in the archives.
Yeah.
We've got
yeah.
the, how many copies? But we said we had a lot of fun, actually. It was, and that although we don't see each other very often, you pick up someone you haven't seen for 20 years, and you just go like, then they still, for some incredible reason, they still think I'm quite a good doctor.
Perhaps we could talk, in fact, about any of the medical cases. What kind of illnesses and injuries were you dealing with?
Well, fortunately, of course, that the Antarctic is well known to be free of infections. So once you've got rid of the infections you've taken down with you, that you don't get coughs and colds and very much. Really, we had that the only serious one that I'll come to at the end, but a certain number of minor injuries that Tom Berry went out and broke a bone in his foot that one evening, and so this was obviously in no way could he be allowed to have any time off, and so that his leg was duly plastered and he was rigged up with a walking arm and stuck in the galley. That otherwise there were a certain amount of back strains, minor injuries, that there was one epic occasion when Johnny Blythe was brought back on a stage snowblind after being out from Hope Bay for about 3 or 4 days in November. "I never took my goggles off, Doc," he said. Unfortunately, there's a lovely picture in the archive showing Johnny Blythe up on the mountain above the Peltier Channel looking out to sea, wearing no goggles. So
the
evidence is there. But the only, there was a certain amount of dental problems that we had, various people's fillings came out, and I dabbled around with a mixture of clove oil and zinc oxide, which seemed to patch most of them up. Mm-hmm. We got a dentist out in 1944 from the Falklands, which is Captain Tomlinson of the Army Dental Corps, who is still in practice in Reading, or just retired, and he fixed everybody up, and we again saw people at the end. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to pull anybody's teeth out, just mm-hmm. as well.
Did you have any kind of anaesthetic, dental?
We had local anaesthetic. In fact, mm-hmm. that the only operation I had to do was I had to operate on a septic finger, and the owner of the septic finger still talks to me, so probably this operation was successful. That one had awful visions, actually, that with a septic finger, that you would start off by something would go wrong. You first have to amputate his finger, and then half his arm, and the rest of his arm. Wasn't quite how you were going to end up. But these were just my private worries. Unfortunately, the other people didn't hear much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the one bad thing was a major disgrace on the people in the Falklands, that they decided that they wanted an extra hand to go down to deception, and that they sent down a man who was known to be unfit. He's over 50, and that nobody asked me or the doctors at the Falklands about checking this man before he was sent down, and that he proceeded to be ill, and that he died shortly after returning to Port Stanley. He was sent up to Montevideo for examination because he had a cancer in his stomach. That he became unconscious in about June of 1945, and that there's a record of I was with Reese at deception, that of cross examination by radio of do this, try that, test his toes, which were, and finally we made the diagnosis, and that he duly recovered from his stroke, which he'd had, but he was dying of his cancer before he got back mm-hmm. to Stanley. He was quite inoperable, but that there was no way in which he should have been sent south. He was not mm-hmm. he was not fit to go. Mm-hmm. The rest of our people were in good nick, and that there was no serious illness. But we did, of course, have one man who was appointed originally as a gentleman called Mr. Buck, who was a geologist, who had a lot of experience exploring in South America, prospecting for minerals. He was a fully trained geologist, and he started off with us in HMS Bransfield, but having found the hardships of and discomforts of the Bransfield, and reckoning quite correct it was going to be geologized worse by the time he went south, that he decided he wasn't fit. He was over 50, not a very well man, and that he was quite sensible to have pulled out. Of course, it did mean that whereas we were supposed originally to have two geologists on the expedition, we did in fact have only Mr. Fletch from Glasgow, mm-hmm. one geologist. Mm-hmm.
I believe you have a theory about one of the purposes of the expedition.
Well, we just wondered sort of why did we go down? That my own view, of course, the Antarctic weather was important, but this was the time of the atom bomb, and although we knew nothing about it when we went south, by the time we came back again, that I reckon it was not unlikely that one of the things we might be looking for was uranium. Mm-hmm. But all around the Antarctic Peninsula, that there are lots of minerals. Some of the mountains are green with copper. And that obviously it is not economically practical to get copper out. But if there were uranium in the Antarctic mountains, then no doubt it might have been practical.
Mm-hmm.
This is purely a speculation,
yeah.
Which I have speculated for 40 years.
What do you remember with particular pleasure when you think back to those days?
There are a number of things. One of them, of course, is the companionship that one gets with people who you live very close together with. That the fact that you know perfectly well that whatever happens, that you are going to have to live with these 9 or 12 men for the next 9 months. It encourages you to get on with them, and that there were no major squabbles or upsets. That the other thing that I was, although I didn't go in many of the sailing trips, but still one at times was walking where no man had ever walked previously. That I thought was rather fun. I think I noticed at the time, as I record found in my letters home, that on the 1st of January 1945, that in our latitude 65 south of Port Lockroy, we were the only people on God's earth who saw the New Year in daylight. That and that these made one think. The other thing is that the Antarctic is quite incredibly beautiful, and that the skies and the mountains and the mock suns, that this is something that one can never forget.
Do you find you can actually remember them? So that was the scenery of the place. Certainly Davis said that he found they felt a great affinity for the wildlife that managed to survive there.
Oh yes, that some of the, of course, yeah, interestingly, of course, was in the winter time there was no wildlife. That the penguins all go north, the gulls all go north. The only people who stay behind are the sheathbills or paddies, that and they, I'm not quite sure what happens to them if there isn't anybody there. They live on our excrement. They seem to be a very a nice bit of stool. It's just the job for a paddy, and but certainly the sight of the penguins coming in the springtime is quite incredible. You see them coming in at Hope Bay. One moment there's nobody there, and then they all start coming, and they leap 6 feet up into the air, up onto the ice front, and all walk across. And there was a picture that the sledge party found of the penguins marching across the ice, over 100 miles away from the nearest water, still heading for their rookery where they went. The penguins are great fun, that, and used to, we had 110,000 of them, because we counted them. And that they are very brave and they stand up for their rights. I think that people were a bit unkind to us and they say that all our dogs ran wild, that they only ran wild for a very short space of time. It was for they were ran wild in Hope Bay probably for about 6 weeks, after which, unfortunately, one lot went out on the ice and never seen again, and they were duly tied up. But the number of penguins they actually killed was remarkable, was not very many.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it difficult, the job of having to kill penguins and seals for the doctors?
Well, I didn't do that. The Geneva Convention protects the doctors. and it was somebody had that, and the seals had to be killed for dog food, and they were frozen solid and sawed up with cross-cut saws.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the total number of seals that were killed in the course of a season to feed the dogs was really infinitesimal compared to the population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy working with the dogs, or were you adopted to the dogs, as it were?
Well, the dogs didn't seem to get much doctoring. They were not very good patients. They had great characters, the dogs had, and that they all. Well, David James was the dog expert. That we were very amused when we were in Port Lockroy, we heard about dogs were coming down, and they said that Captain Marshall has been sent to Newfoundland to collect dogs. He is not a dog expert. So all of us immediately said that whether he liked it or not, by the time they came out to the Antarctic, they were going to be dog experts. We certainly weren't. I think the original Scrimshank, because they worked very hard, But if they can manage to avoid pulling, they will do so. And they aren't dear little bowers either, but they are big, fierce, tough animals. But
they've got a very strong pack instinct as well, haven't they? A sort of a sense of hierarchy.
Oh yes. And that the nursing profession is nothing to the dogs. That everybody has their exact place in the hierarchy, and that the top dog will growl at the second dog, who howl and lie on his back and waving his arms in the air and say that, "Lewis, I'm a miserable dog." And as soon as the top dog has left, the number two goes and does the same to number three and ends up down the line. One of the more unpleasant habits of the dogs is that we had a sunshine recorder the second year, because I'd have a bed. That in spite of the fact it was all supposed to be top secret, there it arrived, duly set for 63 degrees latitude. So obviously someone knew where it was going to be put. And this was put up onto the on the roof of the hut. But unfortunately, that this was the nearest approach to a lamppost that the dogs could see for miles around. And so that it is not very pleasant to try and get out a sunshine card which has been frozen into the recorder with a lot of dog's urine. And it took a lot of, so finally that constructed an anti-rover device which with upright nails skillfully placed around the sunshine recorder so they won't get at it, but yet the dog, if he lifted his leg, would find himself on the nail, so he had to get out of range. And
I believe you had a similar trouble with the rain gauge as well.
Well, the rain gauge wasn't, that was fairly all right, because once the dogs were all these settled when the dogs were tired up.
Mm-hmm.
The rain gauge.
Could we perhaps talk a bit about some of the people that you served with? Most of them sound to be very remarkable people.
Oh, yes, they were a most interesting lot of people, because they've said already that he got this going from nothing, and that I think everybody who works in the BAS does in fact owe something to Ma, because I think that I doubt whether anybody else could have done it. But I believe it was offered to Sergeant Calendar Bingham, but the Navy would not release him from his job because he was a regular naval doctor and was required for the war, that junior naval two-stripe RMVRs were put for two a penny. So that and Ma, that he worked like the proverbial Trojan, and that he got things going. How he did it, I don't know. On the other hand, he did have a habit of if there were two ways to do any job, he would choose the difficult way. He seemed to revel in doing things the hard way, which sometimes was a bit difficult for people working with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a loner, very much so, that Davis had worked with him before, and that Davis was extremely loyal to him. But that he kept his own counsel, that he obviously had secret orders. Presumably he knew what we were supposed to do. If he was, he was the only person who did. He had instructions, and I've no doubt the instructions were that these are top secret and you keep them to yourself. So that with those instructions, that he was to some extent like the captain of a ship, is that he was on his own and he couldn't have any confidants. That I admired Ma, I think he did very well, and that I found out afterwards he almost certainly was unfit, because he had a duodenal ulcer and he'd had injured his back in the past. Mm-hmm. But he certainly, you wouldn't have known that during the time that he was with us. And that he put his heart and soul into it, and as you probably are aware, that during the second year he was supposed to put us up in Hope Bay, and that he decided that he would not be able to carry on, and he was going to resign at the end of the season, having established in Hope Bay. Then he was taken acutely ill and the ship was sent for, and he was sent, he had to go back in a hurry to Port Stanley. Mm-hmm. But he worked extremely hard, and that nobody could have worked harder than he did. Mm-hmm. Andrew Taylor, had a very, very difficult job to follow on, because in December, Ma went up to Stanley to organise the second years. Taylor was left in charge down in Locroy. And that up until the time that Ma went sick and was sent home, Taylor knew nothing about what was going to... He knew nothing about the plans, and as he said in his article in the Mass Journal of 83, that he got no orders. Whatever orders that Ma had certainly were not passed on to Taylor. Ma was in no fit state to pass them on to him. Mm-hmm. when he went, and that he never saw Ma again.
Mm-hmm. Was Ma in a state of exhaustion at that time?
Yes, Ma was, he was in a state of complete nervous and physical exhaustion, and the William Scoresby was recalled to Deception after she'd sailed for home, for Falklands, so that to take Ma back. As soon as he got back to Falklands, he was all right, and so that. Mm-hmm.
So the strain had been lifted from him.
Yes. And of course, by the time we got home, that it was a year later, and that I have to this day no idea of what the official story of why Ma resigned was given. I don't know what it was, but the facts are that they're in Taylor's journal, which you've got a copy of, and that I sent a confidential letter to the Admiralty and to the in charge of the captain of the Scoresby when he went home.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly was he was physically and I think mentally exhausted as a result of his hard work.
Mm-hmm.
That Taylor did extremely well, and that he was known as Quadruplicate Andy, because he said that, and I noticed that the BAS is still afflicted with Quadruplicate Andy. They find copies all over the place. That his doctrine was, if you put it down in writing and in quadruplicate, nobody can lose it, and therefore that you will get, if you've done anything, you'll get the credit for it. If you don't write it down, somebody else will get the credit for it. I thought that Taylor was a very competent and able man, and as you probably know, that he subsequently, that he did a lot of work up in the Canadian Arctic, that he worked in the Canadian Arctic before the war. He was surveying up in northern Canada, and he used to have stories about going out with his pilot called Charlie, and that who they were flying minus 70 below, and that they had to empty out all the oil out of the aeroplane when they got in, and the next morning they shoved it all in the bogey, stoked it all up, and got off before it all froze. And I knew quite well about Charlie, and that I in fact met Charlie with Andrew Taylor in 1959 in Canada, because it turned out I eventually married his niece.
What a small world.
Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And Taylor, he was a good surveyor, he was a good leader, he did I had been in contact with him up till quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
I visited him in Canada, in 59. I haven't seen him since, but I have had odd letters from him.
Mm-hmm. Ivan Lamb seems to have been somewhat of an Edward Wilson of the expedition.
The other thing about Taylor, if I can go
to
you, that he was up on the Dew Line on one occasion, and that he was talking to some Americans. And the Americans were saying, yeah, that I don't know why you fellas haven't got a proper guidebook to tell you all about this. We've got an absolutely marvellous guidebook that tells everything we ought to do in the Arctic. I know, said Taylor. I wrote it.
Good for him.
Lamb was, of all the people of our lot. Lamb was a real scientist. He was probably the best, he's the best botanist to go down since Hooker, if not even better than him. But he was a master of his trade, rather like Ashton was master of his trade, but he was a pure scientist. He encouraged the most uninterested of his companions to an interest in lichens, which most people think of as things that grow on tombstones, but they are now quite fashionable in this country because the air is so polluted you can't grow a decent lichen except in East Anglia. And he would go around and survey some little growth about half an inch long, and this would be described as luxuriant vegetation. He really inspired everybody with the fact that you were working with a pure scientist. I regret to state that one commission he asked me to do when I met him in 1959 was that he wanted me to go and see if I could find a lichen on the top of the highest mountain in Jamaica for his benefit, but I never actually got there. He was very interesting in that, because after he went back to, I mean, it was a long time, he was in Harvard and in Argentina, that the lichen flora that you find at sea level in the Antarctic and the Arctic is the same that you find on the top of the Andes and top of the Rockies. He was very interested in that. He was a very interesting man, very hard working, and although he didn't look tough, he was.
Yes, in fact, Davies made that comment, yes, that he was surprised that someone who'd been in the museum was so physically tough.
Yes. And that he was a kindly man, and as I happened to, I met him in Boston in 1959, and I heard from Taylor just a year ago that he was dying.
Mm-hmm. And who else were you serving with?
The expedition. We have Taff and Fram. You've got already. So Fram was my particular buddy the first year out. We ended up with a cabin one on top, in Lochroy, and I was very sad that he wasn't, because the Tommy Donoghue machine at Port Lacroix had broken down, that it was thought that Farrington, who was a highly skilled senior operator, should go there, whereas could repair the equipment, and that the less experienced operator could in fact work in Hope Bay, where there were other skilled people like Chippy to repair things for him.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that worked perfectly satisfactorily. But Fram, of course, was interesting because he was older than many of us, and he's 13 years older than I am, and that he had spent three cruises with the William Scoresby, and so he really knew quite a lot about what went on.
Mm-hmm.
We had our Falkland Islander, Johnny Blythe, who replaced, he was the handyman. The original handyman we had was a seaman who came out of the pool, whose name was Blair, and that he came down with us, but Ma thought that he probably wouldn't fit for the winter, and so he arranged to have him replaced in March of 44, and Johnny Blythe came down, and it was a great success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you just tell me, for what reason that Ma decided Blair wouldn't be suitable?
No, he was quite right. I think that it was just that some people don't fit, and that I think it was incredible that the rest of us did fit so well. This was his own decision. That he said he had decided that Blair should go home, and radioed for Falklands to send Falkland Islander out. And I've already made rude remarks about people in the Falklands sending out the unfit men in 45, but certainly the other two Falkland Islanders who were sent out were extremely fit and competent, mm-hmm. nice people. Mm-hmm.
Did you find there was any division between the men who were engaged in scientific work and the others?
No. No, that you see, that apart from the fact that the cook, that it was the cook did cooking. Now, the reason for that is that you get, and Tom Berry was not just a cook. I mean, he was a highly skilled cook, but he was, he'd been chief steward and he was just saving discovery. But he was an expert, and that you don't have people who are not experts going out doing scientific work. Why should you have people who are not experts doing the cooking? That I gather from talking to more recent members of the BAS is that they had a phase in which we were all lumping together. We must all be chaps and everybody would take their share of cooking. And I believe they've now gone back to having cooks and handymen. But certainly that nobody, that there was no suggestion that the handymen or the were in any way inferior to the others. Scott, the great criticism of Scott was that, which I think was justified, was that Scott was divided into officers and men, and the officers and scientists and the men, and they were completely separate. Now that was not the case. Mm-hmm. We were officially a naval party, but the Mar, of course, was an RMVR officer. I had a naval commission, but Taylor was in the Canadian Engineers, and Freddie Marshall came up the second year, it was in Remy, and Victor Russell was in the REs. And David James was an RMVR officer. And the rest of us men were not. But I've no idea whether the other, presumably, as we were officially a naval party, but we were under naval discipline. But there certainly was no distinction between the different types of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we could discuss briefly the information that was passed between you and Stanley. Prior to moving bases, both at
Polk
Lock and
from Hope Bay? Well, because the lack of information was probably one of the worst features. That to start with, it was straightforward enough. You went out in the middle of a war and you didn't expect to hear anything. Mm. And that we heard about that we were going to be moved, and the information the first year wasn't too bad, but the second year, because the war was over in the summer of 1945, and one would have assumed that then one would hear a little bit more about what was going to happen. And that I was looking only this morning at a letter I wrote to my mother dated Christmas Day 1945, and that we had heard absolutely nothing about what the whether we were going to be relieved at all. That Andrew Taylor puts in his account for the BAS the fact that we played a hoax on him and said that we were all going to be sent off to Peter the First Island. But that it was not a it was really all unkind. It wasn't funny. That. Mm-hmm. And that my letter, I take that it is freeze up in 10 weeks, and we still have got no idea if we're going to be relieved or not. See, as far as the Eagle was concerned, we knew the Eagle had been smashed up, so that she wasn't going to come down to relieve us. And there'd been various talks about ships coming, in fact, when we went off on our little short sledge trip in January 46, that we had a code. That which was going to be left behind on the we are going to be relieved, we are not going to be relieved, and the other thing was we have been relieved, key under mat.
you missed the boat.
Yes, we missed the boat. And, and in fact, the first thing that we knew that we were being relieved at all was at 3 o'clock in the morning that Marchese was knocking on the front door and saying, don't you chaps want to be relieved?
It's very unfair, really, for, in terms of morale.
No,
it must have been dreadful, really. What was the sledge trip like? You had quite bad services, didn't you?
Yes, but there were two sledge trips were run out by, I didn't go on them,
no.
but there were two reasons. One of them was I did the Met, and the other was that it was thought that as the chap at reception was in a moribund state, that the doctor shouldn't be away. Which is a pity. I went out for a week in the beginning of 46, and it would have been quite fun to have done some sledging. They went out in the winter time, and that they got enmeshed in very deep snow.
Mm. This was the first trip?
For the first trip.
Mm.
They had quite a hairy time. The second trip was obviously easy.
Mm.
That's well described in David James's book. I wasn't on the trip, so that I'm not expressing any judgments of who did what and whether they were right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. But from your own experience in the January trip,
what was that like? Well, because it was light all night, and one of the more interesting things was, of course, it was getting warmer all the time, so we were going on the sea ice, and the sea ice got a crust on top and about 3 foot of water, and so we spent a lot of time splashing around through. The object of the exercise was to take a load of stores and dump it on the mainland at a place called View Point, which was duly done. We took a whole lot of paraffin and stores. Mm-hmm. That was duly dumped, and we came home again. But in 46, you see, the ice had been in for several years then. So in actual fact, looking back, I gather since then there's been open water on several occasions right up to the coast there, until that really with the high temperatures and the sea ice thawing on top, I suppose you might well have gone and taken a trip up Antarctic Sound.
Mm. I think we're coming towards the end now. I must ask you, was there anything you really disliked about being down south?
Well, you mentioned about the lack of news and the fact that one was cut off and that the world went on without you, and that a lot of one's ties when we came back had gone. When one thought about disliking, well, if it was uncomfortable, that it wasn't as uncomfortable as being in the London hospital during the Blitz, I wasn't being machine gunned like my mother was bicycling along the road, I had survived the war, which my father was killed in, so that really there wasn't much to dislike.
Mm. Mm. And what did you do after travelling?
I went back to my medical career where I'd left off it.
Mm-hmm.
I specialised in diseases of children, and I spent 18 years in the West Indies as the University of the West Indies in Jamaica, where I was the first professor of paediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
And after that I came home in 1972 and worked in the National Health Service until I retired last year. I've been on the District Health Authority, I've been on the Central, various medical committees, I've been on the Central Committee of Hospital Medical Services, I've been chairman of the Regional Committee, I've been chairman of the Regional Paediatric Committee, and I've been on the BMA representative body.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done quite a fair amount of politics, but I designed a new hospital, children's ward in the West Indies. I've been instrumental in getting a new hospital in Yarmouth, which is my home county, and I have now more or less, I haven't quite hung my stethoscope up yet, but it gives me, it's rather amusing to, the first time I came here a few years ago, that people look at you as if you're the old man of the sea.
I think it's because you're one of our founder members.
Yes,
yeah.
And the other thing that I was a regular long-term RMBR, I served for 26 years, and I spent the only active bit of that time, I went over to British Honduras on hurricane relief in 1961, which was quite interesting.
That must have been very interesting.
But, we took eight doctors over to relieve in Belize, including that the University of the West Indies has in fact trained doctors from all over the Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean, and that we put the first doctor ever to qualify from British Honduras was put into the first aeroplane that went into Belize after the hurricane.
That's a nice achievement. Is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't covered that you can think of?
Not enough.